This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Bee Birdsong, welcome back. It's wonderful to have you again on the show.
Thank you, Mal. Thank you.
And so very difficult times for humanity. And we're going to talk a lot about the light of picture books and the light that you project. And Bee, it's wonderful to have you back. I'll just mention, because I'm going to forget, that my name is Mel Rosenberg, and I'm speaking to you from war-torn Israel. And I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network, which is quite an honor. But I'm even more honored to have you back because you are a shining light.
Thank you, Mal. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
And for a shy person, you're doing very well. Are you still shy, Bee?
Yes, I am very shy. And events are sometimes difficult for me, but when we focus on books and what we're all trying to do for the children, that really helps me.
Wonderful. So I'm tickled pink. Actually, I'm tickled mauve. I put on my favorite mauve shirt for you.
Ah.
So first of all, let's talk about the reason why we're here. Ostensibly, which is the real reason is because I love to speak to you and share your positivity with the world. And we're here to celebrate your brand new book, which launched in June.
Yeah.
And and a few words about Boop.
Yep. Boop is hopefully a very fun and joyful book. And it asks the reader to go through and boop the snoot on all the dogs that you see. And you've got it's an interactive picture book. And you want to boop all these snoots. And it gives you very clear directions. This is a snoot, and snoots need boops. And it's been a lot of fun to see kids interacting with the book.
Okay, is it for like a little bit of a younger age group than your previous How to Spot a Best Friend and I Will Be Fierce?
Right, it's marked as, I think, 3 to 8, which are all my other books too, but I definitely think this book could be used, and I know it has been used with younger kids with toddlers and even babies as they go through. And because it's a simple text, and, you know, even the youngest, you know, maybe not a newborn, but even a one-year-old can go through and touch all the dog noses and find them on the page.
It's wonderful. So talk about the illustrator, the publisher. We've already talked about your wonderful agent, Melissa Edwards, who was on the show, and she vouched for your incredible story that we'll mention in a few minutes. So this is an opportunity to mention Melissa and the publisher and the editor and the illustrator.
Yes.
And your late dog who inspired it all.
Yes. Thank you, Mal. So I do definitely want to talk about the journey of this book. Lindsay Hunter is the illustrator, and she is amazing. If you look at some of the illustrations here, she's so great. And I love, where's the page? Look at this one where you have to turn the book, and love all the puppies. And Lindsay is so wonderful. And the art for this book was actually chosen for the original art show, and it's in the Museum of Illustration in New York City. Starting today, actually on the 26th, I believe, was the first day of the exhibit. And that's the Society of Illustrators chooses which art will be displayed. And Lindsay's art for this book was chosen for the original art show. So I was really excited about that.
So Bea, you've been very, very proactive in finding me wonderful interviewees. Let's ask Lindsay if she's prepared to be on the program, because I would love to interview her.
Yes, I absolutely. Lindsay is in Scotland. She lives in Scotland, or she's from Scotland and now lives in London. She lives in London now. She's from Scotland. She lives in London, so I'm not sure how that will work out on your timing.
it's actually even better, because it's like 5 after 5. I should mention that if there's an air raid siren, I will disappear for 10 minutes. I'm in my room of love and warmth and light and sharing, but if the nefarious evils bomb us, I will have to protect myself.
Of course.
The editor at HarperCollins?
Yes. So this book is with HarperCollins, and it was actually, this book was acquired by one editor, and then that editor left Harper to go to a different publisher, and it was taken over mid-process.
Mid-boop.
Yes, mid-boop, that's right. And that was the first time that had ever happened to me, but both editors were so wonderful, so amazing about making it as smooth as possible, and there were no hitch, and everything went off exactly as I would have wished. So it was really great.
Wonderful. And now tell us about your dear departed, sadly, dog who inspired the book.
Yes. So this book was inspired by my miniature schnauzer, Bilbo. And we just had to say goodbye to him a few weeks ago. And I'm going to try really hard not to cry about it. But he was 14 years old, and we'd had him since he was maybe about 4, we assume, because of course you never know with a rescue dog exactly how old they are. But we'd had him for almost 10 years, and he was, talk about a light, he was a light for me, and brought so much joy and happiness to our family.
Sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, he actually, at the end of his life, he developed cognitive dysfunction syndrome, which is dementia for dogs. And a lot of people had never heard of that, but that it can happen if a dog lives long enough. He required a lot of extra care in the last months of his life. And we've been dealing with that all summer and into the fall. And it was really difficult for me to say goodbye to him, but I was so blessed to have had him.
So, you know, we talk about rescue dogs. These are dogs that we've rescued. But when I think about a rescue dog, I think about the fact that dogs rescue us as human beings.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
We are rescued back.
Right. Yes. Yes. It's when we went to the rescue to look at the dogs, and we didn't even have an idea, you know, maybe that we would even bring home a dog. We're just looking, we're just browsing. And
you were schnauzing.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the owner of the person running the shelter was bringing dogs out into the yard to for us to see and say hello. And she brought a few out, and then she brought out Bilbo, and he ran right up to me and jumped on my legs like, hello, I'm ready to go home. And she said, I've never seen him do that before. And it was just like he knew we belonged together. And of course, we took him home that day, and that was it.
It was love at first boop.
Yes. Yes.
I love your book for several reasons. Shall I say now, or but first of all, why don't you read to us us a few pages?
Yes. Okay.
So not too many. I don't want HarperCollins to sue us. But.
Okay. Not too many. So I will just point out that in the very beginning, we have a little note to the reader, and it says, Dear Booper, all the dogs in this book want you to boop their snoots. Before you touch a real dog, always ask your big people and the dog's big people if it is okay. And I think that was important because we definitely didn't want children running down the street and trying to touch any dog they see, because, you know, not all dogs like to be booped.
Not only dogs. Guns, yes. Chipmunks, people.
Yes, yes. We need to make sure we are getting permission to touch, right?
Yes.
So here we go. This is a snoot. Snoots need boops. Can you help boop the snoot? A boop is a pat, a gentle tap. Get your finger ready and boop. You booped the snoot. Clap hands, hooray! And now the tail will swish and sway. Oh, look, more snoots. One snoot, two snoots, three snoots, four. Boop, 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 and boop one more. A gentle tap, a friendly pat. And then it goes on with the different dogs, and there's a little bit of a surprise for the reader at the end.
Which you don't want to give away. But this is a wonderful book, gorgeous. And it's a departure from your previous books, Bee.
Yes. All of my other books so far have had... have been a little more traditional, I guess. And this one is a little bit of a breakaway. It's a high concept book and an interactive book, which I've never done before. And it was really an amazing journey with this book because I wrote the manuscript. I had the idea and wrote the manuscript right away. And I sent it to Melissa Edwards, my agent. And I almost always send Melissa first drafts because if she likes the concept and everything, there, you know, I can always work on small things later, but we need to know if she's going to like it or not. So.
Well, hold on. Hold your snoots, dear. Do you ever send something to Melissa that she doesn't like? Does that happen?
Yes. I mean, not that she doesn't like it, but I have sent her things where she said, I think the market is too tight for this, or I don't think there's a place for this right now, or things like that. And we won't send it out.
Because, give us an example.
One that I really loved was a child getting a new sibling. And it was I thought, a very sweet book. And when I sent it to Melissa, she said, this is so sweet. This is so lovely. But new sibling books, it's a really tight market. It's a really crowded market. And so let's not send it out right now. Now, whether we ever come back to that book at some other point, I don't know. But yeah, there have definitely been books that, of course, she's never like, no, I hate this. But she's, you know, always says, I like this, but if it's something that she doesn't think will sell, and that's good, because you want an agent who will tell you, you know, that's part of her job, to say, I think I can sell this. I think there's a place for this. We can get a deal for this book, or maybe not right now. So, So when I sent her Boop, she said, I love this. I think it's hilarious, but let me just send it to a couple of people to see. And actually, this is over email, and I didn't know she meant send it to a couple of editors. I thought she meant send it to a couple of other agents or friends or whatever to see what they thought. And a few days later, she said, we have 4 offers for Boop. And I didn't know we were on submission. So
it's a good thing she didn't say, go into the Barnes & Noble, your book is selling.
Right. So that's the only time that happened. And of course, she thought I knew, right? Like, it was just a misunderstanding on my part. But yeah, so we went to auction for this book and then accepted the deal with HarperCollins. And it was a very different book for me, but I've enjoyed it, and it's a type of book that I do really enjoy. So I'm glad to have one of my own.
And it's very interactive.
Yeah.
Which is also a good thing.
Yeah. I think it's great when kids can do that, can interact with the book.
And also, as a person of belief and wanting to make the world a better place, it's also good to have books that are, I don't know, I would say this. I mean, I would, when this comes out in Hebrew, I will look for young kids here to boop with.
Yes. Well, certainly I would love that. I, as you know, my How to Spot a Best Friend was published in Hebrew. And
I spotted it.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That's wonderful. I did finally get a copy of it mailed to me. So I was really happy to be able to see that. And I don't know if Boop would translate to other languages, but I would be more than happy to see it.
I would think that Boop translates to other languages better than any other book or Boop out there.
that would certainly be wonderful.
It's a very friendly book. And I must admit, I was kind of surprised at the beginning, because your books, they're message-driven without being message-driven. Mm-hmm. You know, I Will Be Fierce, it sends such a very strong message of self-empowerment and overcoming shyness and being afraid, and it does it with such charm, right? And we talked about How to Spot a Best Friend is, for me, a religious book. Mm-hmm. You told me you were Episcopalian. I don't know exactly what that is, but our Jesus, mm-hmm, who was a Jewish rabbi, and whose teachings were about loving your fellow man and being kind and aspiring to be the kind of best friend that you write about.
Yes.
You know, not a friend who gives you a crayon, but a friend who gives you a green crayon, even though that friend knows that you're going to color now 6,237 trees.
See, that's how I know you're a true fan of picture books, Mel, because you remember little details from my books.
I'm sure I got the number of the trees wrong, though.
But it is a green crayon.
and how would I forget that?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about two things. The first thing is, you know, I've been interviewing a lot of nonfiction authors. And Melissa Stewart was on, and we talked about the importance of nonfiction. I told her that I think that there's no such thing as pure nonfiction or pure fiction. It's always somewhere on a spectrum. But you must correct me if I'm wrong, B. But you are a person who wrote nonfiction for years, and yeah. Now you're conquering the world, booping and snooting, and writing real fiction for kids that has a lot of truth in it. So I'm going to shut up now. I want you to talk.
Yes, I did. I wrote freelance for the education market for about 10 years. And it was, and I did write a lot of nonfiction. And I think
Can you give us a few examples?
I wrote mainly in English literature and history, social studies. I'm not really qualified to write science curriculum. I might have edited some science just for the grammar and stuff, but I'm not the one creating it. And I think that of course there can be pure nonfiction in the sense of the kinds of textbooks that you and I probably had when we were in school, that they're a lot of times just statement of facts, right? But the best way to present nonfiction is with a story, with a narrative going through it. So that's okay, I tried to do.
Yeah, but you know that the Jews, they have this comment called oy vey, oh no. When you tell a scientist, right, to tell a story, mm-hmm. usually they bridle. They say, oh no, we just want to tell the facts. But actually, scientists are always telling stories. And the scientific paper is a story about my research. Mm-hmm. And now you're on air in front of the whole world saying that the best way to talk about facts is by telling a story. Why is that?
I think we as people in general are wired for, right? There's a wonderful book by Lisa Crone called Wired for Story. And it is true that we are wired for a story. That's how we understand the world. And you're much more likely to remember something you learned in a classroom or from a book or in any setting if you can connect it to something in your own life. And the way you make those connections is by hearing it in a story form. So there are so many wonderful nonfiction picture books out that do this really, really well. And I haven't written one myself yet. I'm not saying I never will, but I haven't done it yet myself because there are so many masters doing it so well. And it seems like they all understand that, you know, certainly a biography, a picture book biography is told in the form of a story, but seems like every other topic has also, you know, there's a way to tell it so that children have something to grasp onto and say, oh yeah, that's like me. You know, the researcher, the scientist in the lab tried again and again and again with experiments and kept failing until they discovered the truth of what they were trying to discover. And, you know, the kid learning to tie their shoes or to ride a bike can make that little bit of a connection. Oh yeah, I tried again and again and again until I got it right too. And you know, you just need that little bit of connection for it to make sense.
B, I think that you're telling me your next book, dear. we're on a roll here.
Well, listen, I watched one of your other interviews and you were talking about a book about a left-handed character, and I'm left-handed. So, you know, I think we need to get together and write that book.
Who, you and me?
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
I actually have a picture book somewhere with a left-handed character that I wrote very early on, and I'm not even sure which computer it's on, but Yeah, it's actually amazing when you start speaking to creative people, you'll find a much higher percentage of left-handed people in the group than you would in the general population. One of the first panels I ever did in 2019 at NCTE, we had, I think, 6 people on our panel and 5 of us were left-handed. So it was like, this is odd.
I should ask everybody if they're left-handed.
Yeah.
I didn't think about that. Yeah, no, you and I should definitely have a little chat about left-handedness. And of course, I've also tried. And it's not easy. You know, we talk about own voices. You know, you should write about things that you are. Sure. But I think it's harder to write about things that you are because it doesn't let you have that merry little dance, you know, every time I try to write about a left-handed character, it's a character who, you know, does everything differently or whatever, but is not necessarily left-handed. You and I will have a chat about that.
Okay.
Maybe we should offer a prize, you know, for the left-handed book of the year. Anyway. That's incredible. And so do you think, so why do you write fiction? Give me the real reason.
Mm-hmm. I think with fiction, it gives you, well, I mean, partly it's because I've written nonfiction for so long and I wanted to do something different.
Yeah, but I mean, like you're now a famous author. And I want to stress that, and we've talked about that. One in 1,000, one in 5,000, authors gets a publishing deal, and not to mention that your first manuscript was acquired by the first agent that saw it from a slush pile.
Yeah.
And I had to check with Melissa that was true, because it goes against everything I believe in. And it actually happened, and now you have like 4 successful books and more on the way, and this one was acquired at an auction. So, you know, that's wonderful. But, you know, so you have a mandate to essentially write whatever you want. I mean, I can't think that Melissa Edwards now saying, we need a, how about a book about the great North Alaskan Green Hornet? Right. I mean, nobody's telling you what to write about, or are they?
No. Well, I will say that one of my books that's I can't even talk about because it hasn't been announced yet, but it was actually Melissa's idea. That it came from an idea that Melissa gave me. So when that gets announced, we can come back and talk about that one. But
I would love to. I would talk to you every week.
I think there are, of course, IP, intellectual property projects that a lot of writers do, where, you know, the Star Wars novels and things like that, where the idea came from somewhere else. And then the author is asked to take it and run with it, right? And write their own version of that and all of that. So certainly there are projects where the idea came from an editor or a publisher or someone else. But I think even if I were writing nonfiction, I think most nonfiction authors are writing what they are passionate about. You know, they look up at the stars at night and they think, this is what I'm passionate about. I've always looked at the stars. I've always, you know, looked through a telescope. I know a lot about it. Let me share that knowledge with kids. And I guess for me, what I know the most about are emotions and how to deal with them and how to navigate the world. Now that I'm a little bit older, maybe I didn't know when I was a kid. And so I want to help kids do that. And the best way to empower kids for me is through fiction. So that's, I guess, the other reason why I'm choosing to write fiction right now instead of nonfiction is for me, that's the best way to give the message, as you said, hopefully not a in-your-face message, but to give the message that I want to send to kids, that they are special, they have a place in the world, they belong here, and they are, you know, they just, all they have to do is go out and claim it and find what they are passionate about and work towards what they want.
Okay, are you ready for my theory?
Yes.
Okay. The reason that Bee Bird Song writes fiction is because it's fun.
That is the other reason. It is fun. It is fun. You can do whatever you want.
I mean, I'm looking at Boop and I'm saying this is a perfect example of an author who doesn't have to prove anything to anybody, saying, I'm going to write a pure, fun book. And it's not like Boop doesn't have messages all over it. And, you know, kids are going to read into this various things. And I think that that's wonderful. That's what the picture books are for, enabling the reader response. But basically, this is a book of fun.
Yeah.
This isn't the book about being a best friend or overcoming fear and anxiety mm-hmm. and shyness. It's just a book of fun. And
yeah, and that's important, right? Kids need joy. All kids need joy, and a lot of kids maybe don't have joy on a daily basis, you know, in their lives. And if getting this book out of the library or seeing it at school or however they come across it can bring them a few minutes of happiness and joy, then whatever I did to get it published was worth it, because that's what I want.
Okay, and where does this joy? So I'm not finished yet, because joy is also connected with love. Mm-hmm. It's obvious that you love what you're doing.
Yes.
Stephen Fraser once gave a talk about the joy, the rapture, of writing children's books. When is your rapture? When is your joy?
I have two moments of pure joy in the journey of a book. There are a lot of hard moments, right? There, I mean, you send it to Melissa and you hold your breath, right? Right?
Yeah.
And then she sends it out.
I looked at Steve's video, and he's been on the program. Mm-hmm. And I said, what is this? What is this? The joy. It's like the word passion. But then, you know, when you look up the definition of passion, right? And again, this is like a Christian thing, so I'm not a Christian, but the passion is also pain.
Yes. Okay. Yes. But for me, there are all the hard parts, and it's hard for me, just like other authors. Believe me, it's hard for me. And but there are two moments of joy. The first is when I actually write the book. I love that part so much. The finding the perfect word, having the rhythm of the text flow together, creating something out of nothing, out of just my imagination, is an amazing thing. And so that's the first part. And I get that part whether it becomes a book or not, right? So that's good. But the second part, if it does become a book, the second moment of joy for me is when I share it with kids, when it's an actual book in my hands and I go to a library or a school or a bookstore and or a festival, and I get to share it with kids and read it with them, and they tell me what they think about it. You know, I watch their faces as I'm reading. And then they share their thoughts about what I just read. And that's really a gift. That's an amazing gift to hear what your readers think straight from them. And I did a book festival in March, the Lexington Book Festival, and I got to read, Boop wasn't out yet, but of course my other three were. And I got to read them all three as I sat there with the kids. I read all three books. And that was amazing, because usually when you go to an event, you're reading your latest book, and that's, you know, that's all you get to do. You're reading just the one that just came out. But they gave me space and time to read all three of the books that were out. And then I got to hear each of the kids tell me which was their favorite. And they all had, I didn't even ask. I didn't say which one was your favorite. They started volunteering. I liked the one about the friends. I liked the one about, you know, and each of them had reasons why a different one was their favorite. And that was joyful for me too, because I'm, you know, you're each book and all of the writers who are watching this right now, all of your manuscripts have a reader somewhere. It's your job to keep pushing forward and pushing forward and pushing forward to get that book into their hands. But there's a kid there waiting for it. And it might not be for the kid next to them, but there are readers waiting for that book. And that, I mean, as authors, that's, how can we not love that, right?
I'll tell you how we, first of all, I'll share. I think that my book came out after we had our first interview. And just yesterday on Zoom, I read it to 30 kids and two other books that I love. The Paperback Princess, Robert Munsch, and Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus. And a girl, a five-year-old, she says to me, this blew me away. She said, is your book for kids or for adults? And I'm like, another oy vey, man. You know, you've stripped it bare, haven't you, kid? That was really a... So what I did, because I really didn't know, and I still don't know the answer, of course, is I said, what do you think? Mm-hmm. She says, I think it was written for kids. And I say, yeah, I'm glad you say that. But it was actually written for grown-ups too. And so who do you write your books for?
I absolutely write my books for the children. And it can be a tricky thing to navigate, because before your book can reach children, it has to make it through a whole lineup of grown-ups. And grown-ups are not necessarily looking for the same thing in a book that the kid is. So it does have to be. A picture book has to be for kids and grown-ups, because first I have to make it past Melissa. And then we have to make it past not only an editor, but unless the editor is the head of the imprint, we have to make it past their whole acquisitions team. So that's a whole bunch of grown-ups right there. And then we have to make it into
and not necessarily childish grown-ups either.
No, they are fully adult. Unlike you and me, Mel, right? They are fully adult. And you know, you have to, and they have very good reasons why they choose different books, right? And I don't necessarily know those reasons. I'm just writing the book I want to write. But you have to make it past them. And then you have to make it into the bookstores, which means making it past a bookseller, you know, the person who chooses the books that go on the shelves, or a librarian who chooses which books to order for the library. And then you have to make it through either a teacher or a librarian or a parent or a grandparent or an aunt and uncle or someone in that child's life who will purchase it, because 4 and 5 year olds don't have the money to go out and or the means to go out and choose their own books. And you have to make it past. I mean, that's just a huge lineup of grownups that have to approve your book before it can be put into the hands of a child. And so it is true, and Melissa and I talk about this a lot, that this might be a perfect manuscript. And you hear writers say this when you go to a conference or whatever. This is, my kids loved it, you know, or my students loved it if they're a teacher. But first, before it can get there, it has to make it through the grownups. So it has to have something that will make all of those adults say, okay, yes, I agree that this is a good book for a child. and that children will like it, and that, you know, it will be an important addition to the canon of children's literature. And so we don't want to have to consider adults in writing. And I don't, when I first write it, I don't really. But in the end.
Hold on, Bisa. I like it. This is the segue towards my question.
Okay.
You were a kindergarten teacher, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
So you have a one up on everybody who wasn't a kindergarten teacher. By the way, I was a little bit of a kindergarten teacher. I assisted my late mother, but perhaps not enough like to have the expertise that you do. But who is that person that you write to mm-hmm. when you have the idea for Boop or for Sam's First Word or How to Spot a Best Friend or I Will Be Fierce? I have a theory, so you know, you can say whatever you want, but I'm a scientist. I'm going to decide.
Yeah. I think initially there are probably a lot of kids in my head, right? There's my son when he was that age. He's 25 now, but you know, when he was that age. And I have 7 nieces and nephews, and you know, so that's a lot of kids right there. And my cousins have kids, you know, so I have a lot of kids, or I have had, in the case of some of them who have grown up now, a lot of kids in my life. And of course, former students. But I do have them in my mind sometimes, different ones. But I think what it comes down to is I'm writing for me, right? I'm writing for the kid that I was.
I'm
writing. Yeah, I'm writing for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 year old me. And what book did I need? Yeah.
And we talked about this. You know, I Will Be Fierce. That was the book you needed when you were 5.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. how to spot a best friend.
Yes.
You needed that book too.
Yeah. I think you, because I have had friends in my life who were not true to the friendship as I was. And so absolutely, I think for me, and I'm not saying for any other author, because everyone writes for different reasons, but for me, in the end, I'm writing for the child I was.
And then, so it's interesting, because then you have to be very lucky with the reader response to find the child and the other, you know, dozen disciples that have to select your book before it gets into the hands of the child that you really want to read it.
Yes. Well, I think the best piece of advice for that, and I'm not saying this lightly as if it's an easy thing to do, but the best piece of advice is you want to write about a universal emotion, a universal experience, even like the first day of school, but in a very specific way, in a way that's only you can tell that story, in a way that's specific to your voice, your experience, the words you needed to hear as a kid, whatever it is that's specific to you. But the underlying thing has to be universal. So whatever that is, you know, there are a lot of books about grief and losing a grandparent. And there are books about, of course, the first day of school, or trying to learn to do something, or thinking that you're different as a kid, right? That's a common theme. Or being afraid to speak up. Or those are all universal experiences, in that most people will have had a moment of that in their lives, where they were trying to accomplish something and couldn't do it, or where they had a first day, whether it was at school or a new job or you know, moving to a new home or whatever. They've had that experience of being new to a situation.
But I'm still going to think, B, that there's a second step, and this goes back to our discussion about left-handedness. There has to be a distillation process, mm-hmm. you know, because I was miserable as a left-handed kid. I suffered, but the reason I haven't, maybe now you and I will find them, but the reason up until now is because I haven't been able to distill this mm-hmm. into a story.
Yes.
It's not a story of pain.
Well, and I think that's like you said, it's more difficult to write from your from what you know, from your own experience. I think that's why, because
you have to write from what you know.
You have to write from what you know, but of course, what you know is your own pain, your own struggle. And so, yeah, absolutely. You, you sit at the computer or with the notebook, and you try to put all of that into words, and not just your own words, like if it was a journal or a diary, but words that other people will connect to, that other kids will connect to, that other grownups will connect to. And yeah, it is an incredibly difficult thing that we do. And sometimes that idea can get lost, especially with picture books. Most people don't say writing a novel is easy, because they're looking at all those pages. You had to fill all those pages. But a lot of people, a lot of first-time writers, when you go to conferences and different things, think that writing a picture book is easy. It's 200 words, 300 words, 400 words, no problem. It must be easy because it's short, right? But, you know, I think it was Mark Twain that said, if I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter. It's incredibly difficult to tell a whole story with all of that pain and struggle and anything else you want to put into it in there, in an engaging way, by the way, in under 500 words. That is a difficult thing to do. And I think you and I and probably everyone watching this are blessed that we get to do that.
So I'm going to go back to something that you shared last time. And that is that you had experience writing things in 500 characters.
Yes.
and that's wild, because when I was starting out in my serious journey to be an author, Karen, my early on mentor, she said to me, I want you to take this story and write it in 18 words. Mm. Which is impossible, but I did, sort of. And then she looked at me and she says, oh, I didn't really mean 18, you know, it could be 23 or 26, but this is definitely, you know, your ability to write these one sentence pitches, these PB pitches, PB pitches tomorrow. I don't think anybody really looks at them, but it's good for the author to practice trying to, and if you can't write your story in a sentence or two, there might be something wrong with your story.
Yes. I mean, what is the story about? And you need to be able to tell us. If you say, well, it starts with this and then this happens and whatever, you're telling us the plot, but you're not really telling us what is it about? What's the heart of your story? And that's what your one sentence pitch should be. What's the heart?
Wow. That is so powerful. B, I'm going to go back now and rewrite all my pitches. Not what is your story about. What is the heart of your story?
Yeah.
You are incredible. This is the best place to say the following. Be Birdsong, you are incredible. I'm going to cry when we say goodbye today, but hopefully this war will be over soon and we'll be able to reconnect and write our left-handed story together, or talk about shining light on people. Before we leave, one sentence on your book that's been announced but isn't out yet on the family tree, which is intriguing. Intriguing! Intriguing. Oi, sorry.
That's all right. Next fall of 2024, my next book will be released. It's called How to Grow a Family Tree. And it's about a girl who lives with just her mother. And she discovers that chosen family can be just as important as your biological family.
That's the heart of the story.
That's the heart of the story.
B. Birdsong, you're incredible.
Mel, so are you.
Thank you. Keep shedding light and joy and wonder, and sharing your incredible stories with children all over, here in Israel too, in Hebrew.
Yes.
So thanks.
Thank you
so
much.
We have to say goodbye. Goodbye. And we've been with Bee Birdsong celebrating her new book out just this summer, Boop, an interactive book of fun and joy. And I am Mel Rosenberg, the host of the Children's Book Network for the new, no. See, I am, don't laugh, I'll get it right. My name I know. I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. See, that's what a war can do to you. B, this has been wonderful. You've taken my mind off of the hatred and evil and darkness. And we've spent 45 minutes talking about light and joy and sharing love and friendship.
Thank you so much, Mel. Thank you.